From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome. I'm Larry Mantle. You're listening to music from the soundtrack of Judas and the Black Messiah. The film stars Daniel Kaluuya, Lakeith Stanfield, and Jesse Plemons. Shaka King directs the story, which is based on the life of Fred Hampton, the chairman of the Illinois Black Panther Party, and his betrayal by FBI informant William O'Neill. The comedy Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar is written by and stars Kristen Wiig and Annie Mamolo. Josh Greenbaum directs. And we'll hear about the romantic drama Supernova, which is a British road trip starring Colin Firth and Stanley Tucci. Those are just a few of the big films coming up this week on Film Week. Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. So glad you found our podcast to listen to the program this week. I'm joined by Leah Lowenstein, KPCC film critic, also columnist for the Santa Monica Daily Press, Peter Rayner, KPCC film critic and with the Christian Science Monitor as its film critic, and from synagogues.com, KPCC critic Wade Major. We begin this week with Supernova, starring Colin Firth and Stanley Tucci. Their characters take a road trip across England. The film written and directed by Harry McQueen. Peter, tell us about Supernova.
This is a very touching movie. Stanley Tucci and Colin Firth play a gay couple. They've been together for about 20 years. They're packed into an old camper going across England to the Lake District. The crux of it is that Stanley Tucci's character, Tusker, has early onset dementia. And so there's a kind of mournfulness that hangs over this trip because of what's in store. And they visit some family friends, and they do a lot of stargazing. Theoretically, Sam, who's a pianist, is ending up with a piano recital he hasn't played in a while. And Tusker, the Tucci character, is an author who is having trouble writing. And there are no flashbacks. I don't recall with the relationship. It's all sort of done in the present, which I think is a wise choice, because you really see it played out between them, how these men interact. And the movie is a little draggy and predictable in some ways, but it's immensely touching because the two actors are so marvelous together, and it really shows off just what wonderful performers they are and how they relate to each other.
We're talking about Supernova, starring Colin Firth and Stanley Tucci. Lael.
Yes, I agree with Peter. This is a really nicely restrained film and beautifully underplayed performances by Tucci and Firth. What I really appreciated about it was the fact that it doesn't sentimentalize their relationship. It could be any couple anywhere that happened to have been together for a long time. And in particular, these actors are so gifted, so strong, that the characters really feel lived in. So there are no flashbacks, Peter is right, but we get a real sense of the weight of their time together and how much they mean to each other.
Supernova, Wade.
Yeah, that's the three for three. I agree completely. You're not watching this for the story. You're not looking for surprises and twists and where is this going to go. We know these emotions. It's a road trip. It doesn't pave any new ground, but what it does is it gives us two extraordinary actors at the peak of their performance abilities. I was reminded a little bit of how Tom Courtney and Albert Finney interface with each other in The Dresser. You have some wonderfully theatrical scenes that just go on for a very long time, but the actors just make the best use of the space and of the emotions and of their proximity to each other on the screen. It's really just a beautiful tour de force by two great actors.
We're talking about Supernova, starring Colin Firth and Stanley Tucci. It's rated R. It's in select theaters and available on demand, including Fandango Now, iTunes, and Google Play, starting next Thursday. You can see it at home. Judas and the Black Messiah tells the story of Fred Hampton, chairman of the Illinois Black Panther Party. Daniel Kaluuya stars with Lakeith Stanfield and Jesse Plemons. Shaka King is the director. Will Burson and King are the screenwriters. Lael, Judas and the Black Messiah.
This is a really, really well done portrait of a true story, a man named William O'Neill, who became an FBI informant. O'Neill was a petty thief, and he was brought in by Jesse Plemons of the FBI, who, in a terrific performance, by the way, and is sort of forced into being an informant and infiltrating the Black Panthers. Kaluuya is the local leader, Fred Hampton, and there's just a wonderful kind of interplay between the different actors and also bringing up all kinds of issues of course, obviously race and oppression, but also, you know, loyalty and what it means to be Black and what it means to own your loyalty and to owe to the FBI as well. So it's really a complicated dynamic and beautifully played, I thought, all the way around.
Judas and the Black Messiah, Wade.
Yeah, it is. This is a terrific movie. I'm kind of amazed that no one has told this story previously, because it's such an extraordinary episode in history with such strong characters. It begs for dramatic treatment. And I think Shaka King, who co-wrote and directed, does an amazing job here. Really, really captures the era. It still has a tiny bit too much gloss on it for my taste, although not nearly as much as something like the Chicago 7, which I think is just a wash in gloss. I kind of like these stories to sort of feel like they have the grunge of the 1970s on them. That is caviling a little bit here. It is, you know, independent of that. It really, really hits all the beats. It's very faithful to the history. And as good as Daniel Kaluuya is, we have to be very fair here. Daniel Kaluuya is playing the flashier figure. Fred Hampton was amazing and charismatic, which was the whole point. Lakeith Stanfield is the real standout here. The depth and the richness to his performance is far beyond anything he's done before. And I don't want to sell short what Jesse Plemons does, because Jesse Plemons is playing also a very, very complex character who is also incredibly understated. So I think all three of them nail their performances. Kudos to Shaka King for taking an incredibly powerful story and telling it right.
Judas and the Black Messiah stars Daniel Kaluuya and Lakeith Stanfield with Jesse Plemons, Shaka King, the director and co-screenwriter. It's rated R. It's on HBO Max, and you can see it on the drive-in screens at the Arena Cine Lounge in Hollywood, the Mission Tiki in Montclair, and the Van Buren in Riverside. The comedy Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar stars Kristen Wiig and Annie Mumolo. Jamie Dornan is well in the cast. Josh Greenbaum directed. The film is written by Mumolo and Kristen Wiig, the stars of the film. Wade, what'd you think of Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar?
And Larry, you have to say it with a Midwestern accent. It has to be Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. You have to. You got to emphasize the way, because that's the only way that it'll ever really, really resonate. This is unbelievably funny. It's so funny that even with headphones on, I apparently was laughing so hard that I woke my family up last night. So this is so funny. Kristen Wiig and Annie Mumolo, who of course were in The Groundlings together, they wrote Newlyweds 10 years ago and haven't written anything together since. And they've never starred opposite each other as a team at all. So this is their chance. They wrote this together. They star in it together. And they're like a Midwestern ab fab. They're these two women who work at a furniture store in Nebraska, and they get laid off. And what are they going to do to reinvent their lives? Well, they are going to go to this resort town in Florida. There's a B plot to this, which is this weird kind of almost Austin Powers-y, James Bond kind of end of the world espionage story that weaves in a very funny way with Jamie Dornan. But for the most part, this is very broad comedy. It's Kristen Wiig and Amy Mumolo doing this unbelievably funny pairing together, where they just bounce off of each other through the whole movie, and it is endlessly funny. I just can't recommend it highly enough. You'll laugh yourself delirious.
The film is Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. I'm not sure I can say it with the proper accent. Kristen Wiig and Annie Mamolo, Jamie Dornan in the cast, Josh Greenbaum directed. It's rated PG-13, and it's available on demand platforms, including Google Play, Fandango Now, iTunes, and Vudu. The World to Come is a drama starring Catherine Waterston, Vanessa Kirby, and Christopher Abbott. Mona Fastvold is the director. The screenwriters are Ron Hansen and Jim Shepard. This is a period piece from the middle of the 19th century. Peter, please tell us about The World to Come.
This is set in upstate New York, very harsh climate, very snowy. Very mid-19th century, as you said. People eke out their lives doing chores and frostbitten environs. Catherine Waterston's character, Abigail, lost a child to diphtheria, and that sort of messed up her marriage with Casey Affleck. And so they don't really have much to say to each other for the most part. It's kind of a frozen marriage. Vanessa Kirby's character, Tally, who's a new neighbor with long, streaming auburn tresses and very outgoing, and she becomes fast friends with Abigail and then eventually lovers. This is a very damped down, rather straight-laced movie. It's not Portrait of a Lady on Fire. It's sort of Portrait of a Lady lightly singed. but it does have some terrific performances in it, especially from Vanessa Kirby, who's on a roll these days after Pieces of a Woman. This is a really first-rate performance in a movie that needs all the energy it can get.
The World to Come, Wade.
I agree completely. Portrait of a Lady Lightly Singed really nails it. And I thought Ammonite had some of the same problems. I think this is better than Ammonite, to be honest. I think it's a little deeper and richer. But it is not Portrait of a Lady on Fire. It sort of started like a Kelly Reichardt movie for me. And then it kind of deviates into David Hamilton territory. And then it gets its square again and becomes kind of a Kelly Reichardt film again by the end. It is beautifully made. And it is like Supernova, beautifully, beautifully acted. The narrative is a bit thin, and it kind of loses its way a few times. But if you can, as with Supernova, if you can hang on to the performances, it's well worth watching.
Performances coming from Catherine Waterston, Vanessa Kirby, Mona Fastvold directing the R-rated The World to Come. It's in select theaters. The romantic comedy To All the Boys, Always and Forever stars Lana Condor and Noah Centineo. Michael Filmagnari is the director of the film, and Katie Lovejoy wrote it from Jenny Han's novel. To All the Boys, Always and Forever. Wait.
Netflix is apparently doing very well with this young adult genre, and they're all kind of the same. This is the second in a series, and they all sort of start with a film about a girl in high school and her romantic travails and the boy that she wants, and then the romance takes off. And then the second films in the series always deal with the struggle of, you know, are we going to go to college and where am I going to go, and the usual university application nightmare. That's what this is. Lana Condor and Noah Centineo are boyfriend and girlfriend. They're both hoping to go to Stanford, but he gets in and she doesn't. What a crisis. What are they going to do? Well, maybe she'll go to Berkeley so they can be close, but she might go to NYU, and that's really far away. If that sounds incredibly trivial, it is. So unless you're 18, 19 years old and this is the struggle of your life, it's kind of an eye roller for anybody older than, I think, 25. However, that being said, as silly and kind of trivial as it is, it's very well made. And Lana Condor, who was something of a YouTube celebrity before becoming an actress, is so adorable and so unbelievably charismatic. You kind of don't care how dumb the movie is otherwise. She is just an absolute delight to watch.
To All the Boys, Always and Forever, rated TV-14, and it's streaming on Netflix. French Exit, a comedic drama starring Michelle Pfeiffer. The film is directed by Azazel Jacobs. Patrick DeWitt, who wrote the novel on which it's based, adapted it for the screen. Lael, please tell us about French Exit.
Well, I actually would have liked to take a French exit from French exit, which means I always thought it was an Irish goodbye, but a French exit also means to leave without saying anything. Apparently, people have praised this film, but I didn't get it. I felt it was a very mannered performance by Michelle Pfeiffer as this aging socialite who basically out of money and down on her luck decides to leave New York and move to Paris with her cat, and who she doesn't like, and her son played by Lucas Hedges. And she kind of starts her life anew there, but not really. She's still very cranky and very snobby, I thought. And I didn't feel like her performance, which is supposed to anchor the film, was really accessible. So that was a problem I had with it.
French Exit. We'll hear what Wade and Peter thought of the dramatic comedy or comedic drama starring Michelle Pfeiffer. The film is at the Vineland Drive-In in the City of Industry and rated R. We'll also hear about the comedic drama Breaking News in Yuba County, which stars Allison Janney and Mila Kunis, along with Awkwafina. You're listening to Film Week on the podcast, available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. I'm joined this week by critics Wade Major, Peter Rayner, and Lael Lowenstein. Lael was just telling us about French Exit, a comedic drama starring Michelle Pfeiffer. Wade, what did you think?
Well, I am a lifelong Michelle Pfeiffer sycophant. I still defend Grease 2 to this day. So I can find no fault in her performance. I thought she was wonderful. However, I do concur with all of Lael's other reservations. I think it's a fairly pretentious plot that gets more pretentious as it goes on and kind of meanders into these weird existential places that you normally expect to be in a stage play. I mean, you know, that her deceased husband is reincarnated as a cat and Tracy Letts does the voice of the cat, and Tracy Letts steals the movie from everyone else as the voice of a cat that you only hear in these seance sessions. It's very bizarre. It doesn't really hang together. It feels like it's just being pretentious for the sake of being pretentious. And you never really feel like they're in Paris. They might as well have been in any other city in an apartment. It never really captures France. So the French part of the exit isn't even that French.
French Exit, Peter.
Yeah, it would be hard to defend this movie as a good movie, but it does sort of have its guilty pleasures. I do like Michelle Pfeiffer in it. Yes, she's overacting and over theatrical and over emoting and all that stuff, but I do think that's the character. In other words, she's playing a diva, so it sort of makes sense that she's doing this. And there are moments in the performance where she drops all of that, and you can see, you know, the sort of real person come through, and I think that sort of is a tip-off that this is more than just a show turn. And there's some very funny moments. My favorite moment is when she's with her son in a Parisian restaurant, and the waiter is not paying attention to them. So she sprays some perfume over the flower display on the table and then sets it on fire. Sort of typical of who this character is.
French Exit, rated R. Again, you can see it at the Vineland Drive-In in the City of Industry. Breaking News in Yuba County, comedy drama starring Allison Janney, Mila Kunis, and Awkwafina. Tate Taylor, the director. Amanda Udoko, the screenwriter. Wade.
Boy, what an awful misfire this is. I just can't find anything good about this. And it's really sad given all the people who are involved in it. This is another one of these movies that we've gotten fairly routinely since Being There that wants to explore the cult of celebrity and personality and how we are media obsessed and how easy it is to become a media personality without doing anything substantial for earning it. Being There still is the gold standard for that. And I'm not sure why everyone keeps trying to tell that story when Being There did it perfectly. But nonetheless, here we are. And Allison Janney plays a very insecure woman, always reciting these affirmations to herself, whose husband, played by Matthew Modine, dies after sex with a prostitute. And she sees an opportunity to hide his death, pretend that he disappeared, and then kind of pass herself off as a victim of of some kind of circumstance so she can become famous on talk shows and in the news and so forth. And of course, this spirals out of control, and there are all these other circumstantial issues, the criminals who are laundering money through the efforts of her husband. And, you know, it winds up getting much bloodier and nastier than a dark comedy should. And it's never really that funny to begin with, even when it's trying. Mila Kunis and Allison Janney are in no way properly cast as sisters. That makes no sense at all. Awkwafina is kind of wasted as this really tough, you know, daughter of a mobster. And Tate Taylor, who so beautifully directed The Help, doesn't really seem to know what tone to capture here. He doesn't know where to put the camera. He doesn't know how to direct his actors. He just seems lost with material that hasn't really been properly honed in the first place.
Breaking news in Yuba County. Lael.
I think it was about half redeeming. I kind of agree with Wade that it was mostly terrible, but I thought the first half was actually quite funny. Janney is such a good actress. She can be, you know, the confident C.J. Craig of the West Wing. She can be the mom, Tanya Harding's mom, and get an Oscar for that. And she can be this sort of rundown affirmation repeating sad sack. And I thought she was delightful as Sue Buttons, this housewife who's just, you know, has no purpose in her life. Wade is right that being there was the kind of apotheosis of the celebrity obsessed culture that we live in. It still is. And I actually thought Tate Taylor did a decent job for the first half or so, and then it just descends into chaos, bloodshed, and ridiculousness, which didn't really help his cause. But, you know, half of it was kind of funny.
Breaking news in Yuba County's rated R. You can see it on multiple on-demand platforms, including Amazon Prime Video, Fandango Now, and Vudu. Lapsus, a sci-fi drama starring Dean Imperial, Madeline Wise, and Dora Madison. Noah Hutton is the writer-director. Lapsus, Peter.
This is a quirky, micro-budget sci-fi picture. It's not up there with The Vast of Night from last year, but I found it sort of engaging. It's about the there's a quantum computing revolution that's going on, and they need workers to lay cable between these large cable networks. And so people, you know, vie for medallions to get the permits to do this. And what's interesting about the movie, as they've promoted it, is that it's one of the rare sci-fi movies that's a blue-collar sci-fi movie. It deals with the grunts on the ground who are doing the laying in of the cable and all that kind of activity that you don't normally see in sci-fi movies that are generally much more white-collar. It's very minor. That has all sorts of weird things going on in it. There's cabling robots that scamper through the forests where the cables are being strung and so forth. But Dean Imperial, who plays the lead character, who's trying to help his ailing brother by taking on this job with a kind of shady permit that he's obtained, is quite good. And one of the cablers, Anna, is marvelously played by an actress I'm unfamiliar with, Madeline Weiss. Just a really terrific performance.
Lapsus, the film is unrated, and it's on Lemley's Virtual Cinema, also on-demand platforms Vudu, Fandango Now, and iTunes. The HBO documentary Black Art, In the Absence of Light, is directed by Sam Pollard. Wade?
Absolutely one of the best documentaries I've ever seen about art. This is superb. It begins by focusing on the 1976 exhibition by David Driskell that illuminated the work of black artists at the time, which was very, very controversial. And it kind of uses that as a jumping off point to talk about the contributions of black artists generally, both previously and today. And the theme of it is really set up very early on, where with footage of David Driskell, who just passed away about a year ago, where he says that these are artists. They're not just black artists. You can say that, but they are artists. And the reason that they did the exhibition was because the canon of American art is not complete without their inclusion. So he doesn't want them separated out strictly as there's black art and then there's other art. It's necessary to pay attention to them so that they can be brought into the greater body of art that they've always wanted to be a part of. And all the artists who are discussed in this, and there are artists who have passed on, artists who inspired the exhibition, artists who were exhibited in it, and then younger artists who were inspired by them, they're all interviewed. And they all discuss this, that yes, I am a Black artist, but I am also an artist, and I am also an American artist, and I can be all of these things at the same time without having any of them necessarily cancel the others out. And their diversity is what is so beautiful about this, how different they are, how their philosophical approaches to art, to light, to shading, to color, to interpretation is just so richly discussed. And it's amazing that in less than 2 hours, you have so many voices and so many different philosophies and ideas packed into this movie. It is incredibly rich, and it is so inspiring.
We're talking about the documentary Black Art in the Absence of Light, directed by Sam Pollard. It's unrated. It's on HBO and also on HBO Max. The fantasy film The Map of Tiny Perfect Things stars Catherine Newton and Kyle Allen. Ian Samuels directs. Lev Grossman wrote the screenplay adapting the novel of the same name, The Map of Tiny Perfect Things. Lael.
This is sort of like Groundhog Day for the teen set. We've seen a few of these temporal anomaly movies recently, including Palm Springs. Of course, there's always Groundhog Day. Edge of Tomorrow is another one of them. But this is one in which a young man wakes up the same every day, goes through the same day. He is actually so adept at knowing every cue that's going to happen, every cup that's going to drop, every stranger that's going to ask for directions, that it's sort of this wonderfully choreographed opening sequence where he, Mark, played by Kyle Allen, just runs through his day and catches the cup before it drops, gives the directions before the stranger asks, all these sort of wonderful little gestures. And it's got a nice, really wonderful sort of fluidity to it. He then happens to meet a young woman, Margaret, who is also experiencing temporal anomaly. She's the only one like him who is repeating the same day. And together they have to figure out how they got here and how do they get out of it. So we've seen some of this before. Some of it's original, but some of it's a retread. But for the most part, I thought it was a kind of a sweet, gentle romance with some nice humor. And I like the fact that it upright acknowledges its debt to Groundhog Day. Even in the movie, they talk about it. So I appreciated that.
The Map of Tiny Perfect Things, Peter.
Yeah, it's very minor. The Catherine Newton and Kyle Allen do have some very good chemistry together. And yes, they do acknowledge Groundhog Day. They better, because it's really the template. And then, of course, we had Palm Springs more recently. I wonder if there's a think piece in the idea that there are so many of these sort of time loop movies that seems to be happening. They were made before the pandemic, but it seems as if they kind of, look forward to a different type of narrative where it seems like time is constantly repeating itself.
The Map of Tiny Perfect Things, Wade.
If we keep having these, I will feel like I'm in the same day over and over. I the only thing I would add, I agree completely with everything that's been said. I would only add that Catherine Newton is just an absolutely wonderful actress. She was so good in Freaky with Vince Vaughn just some months ago. She's got a great future. She's delightful in this.
The Map of Tiny Perfect Things, rated PG-13, and it's on Amazon Prime Video. Show Me What You Got is a romantic drama set in Los Angeles, starring Christina Rambaldi and Nesan Funlahi. The film is directed by Svetlana Svetko, who co-wrote it with David Scott Simon. Peter, what'd you think of Show Me What You Got?
Well, it's in glossy black and white. It's set in L.A. originally. These three beautiful people hook up and form a menage. They end up traveling to Italy because one of the guys, Matilda Menassi's is a character, Marcello, is the son of a famous soap opera actor star, and they want him back. It's all sorts of complications. When they're in L.A., there's a lot of couch surfing. They visit Joshua Tree. She helps rescue dogs. There's a voiceover narration, which sort of tells you what's going on in case you're not paying attention. But the whole movie is very keyed to the French New Wave. It's bizarre. I mean, it's really very much drawn from, you know, Jules and Jim, and there's some Y Tu Mama Tambien in there too, which is not French New Wave, but it's clearly it's more than homage. It's just really drawing on that type of film, which hasn't really been in vogue for a long time. So it's sort of an anomaly in that sense. And I'm glad that the filmmakers are still, you know, revering Truffaut, but I think aside from the chemistry between the three characters here, it sort of doesn't really go anywhere, but it's fun to watch.
All right, we're talking about Show Me What You Got, which is unrated, and it's on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. The comedy mystery Me, You, Madness is really the baby of Louise Linton because she wrote and directed it and stars in the film. Wade?
Oh, my. You know, Larry, there are movies that are so bad they're good. This is a movie that is so terrible, it's incomprehensibly brilliant. For those who don't know, Louise Linton is Steve Mnuchin's wife. She is Scottish. And all I can say about this movie is a female version of American Psycho shot like a car commercial by an aging scream queen who was never a scream queen to begin with. It elevates vanity to the level of high art. This is entirely about her. She breaks the fourth wall liberally. She's a hedge fund manager who has, you know, a sidebar of homicide. She likes to lure men and kill them and chop them up. And it's all part of being a hedge fund manager and being incredibly wealthy. And she'll take time out to make that essential trade. And then she meets the guy that she wants to kill, but it turns out that maybe they're meant for each other. And it is so vain and so self-celebratory that at a certain point, you just have to kind of fold in and accept it. It's hilariously bad and brilliant at the same time.
Me, You, Madness is rated R. It's on Fandango Now, iTunes, and Vudu. It's Film Week. So glad to have you with us this week. We remember actor Christopher Plummer, who passed away a week ago, as we continue. It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Such pleasure to have you with us, with our critics Peter Rayner, Leah Lowenstein, and Wade Major. We're going to remember a couple of film giants who left us within the past week. First, Christopher Plummer, best known as Captain Von Trapp in The Sound of Music, died just over a week ago at the age of 91. He was the oldest actor to win an Oscar for a performance. At the age of 91, he got the Best Supporting Oscar for the film Beginners. Wade, quick thoughts on Christopher Plummer and his career.
One of the greatest things that Canada has ever given to Hollywood. I mean, we all think of him primarily as Captain Von Trapp in The Sound of Music, which is iconic for generations and generations of filmgoers. But his body of work is so much deeper and richer. I mean, you even think of him as playing Mike Wallace in The Insider, going toe-to-toe with Russell Crowe in that movie, most recently playing Getty for Ridley Scott. I mean, he replacing Kevin Spacey in that movie at the last minute. I mean, he's really an iconic figure, and his longevity is unprecedented.
And a terrific voice actor as well, Up, An American Tale, among others. Lael, your thoughts about Plummer's career?
Yes, I mean, legendary. And of course, yeah, his singing Edelweiss will live forever in my memory, but I also do honor him and appreciate his work in Beginners and All the Money in the World and several of his other films. He was a great, great actor.
Peter.
Yeah, one of the great actors. You know, he hated The Sound of Music. He always referred to it as The Sound of Mucus. But, you know, he learned to live with it, and I've never been a huge fan of that movie, so I don't think of him in those terms. He's marvelous as Mike Wallace in The Insider. He was great as Tolstoy in The Last Station. He's a terrific bad guy in an underseen movie that Curtis Hanson wrote called Silent Partner from the 70s. I saw him on Broadway play Barrymore, John Barrymore, and it was just an incredible experience. One of the great regrets of my life is I was never able to see him as Iago in Othello on Broadway. I mean, I can just imagine how great he would have been in that role if I'd seen it. But he also wrote a tremendous autobiography, which is one of the few celebrity biographies that's actually readable. just a man who would be king. He was just one of the great actors.
Also passing just over a week ago, Jean-Claude Carrier, the Oscar-winning screenwriter de Belle du Jour, among others, The Unbearable Lightness of Being. He died at the age of 89. Peter?
Yeah, he was one of the great screenwriters. He wrote many of Buñuel's later famous great movies, Belle du Jour, Obscure Object of Desire, Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie. He also wrote Unbearable Lightness of Being for Phil Kaufman. He did The Tin Drum for Schlondorf, most recently at Eternity's Gate, the Van Gogh movie with Willem Dafoe. He did a major stage production of Mahabharata, which was filmed by Peter Brook. Just an amazing director. I had dinner with him in Paris in the late 80s after a film festival, as it turns out, and we went to an Indian Raga concert at the time that he was doing Mahabharata, and it's one of the great memories for me.
All right. Let's turn our attention now to the National Society of Film Critics, which Peter Rayner is a member. That organization has lodged a protest against Variety printing an apology for the review that it did of the film Promising Young Woman. The star of Promising Young Woman, Carey Mulligan, was not happy about a portion of that review from freelance critic Dennis Harvey. A portion of it mentioned that she's a fine actress, but said that Mulligan was a bit of an odd choice as this admittedly many-layered apparent femme fatale. Variety then, after Mulligan expressed her concern about what she took as a comment on her appearance, Variety said, "We regret the insensitive language and insinuation that minimized her daring performance." Peter, I want to start with you as a member of the National Society. Why was the organization angry about Variety's apology?
Because I think the timing of it, first of all, was ridiculous. The review was published a year ago. And only now is this happening, which is coincidentally, you know, during awards season. I think the feeling among the critics, is that your publication should not issue a disclaimer of your review. If you have a problem with the review, then the editor and the writer should work it out in advance of its being published. Or if it's published and you don't like what's there, you can, you know, do an editor's note somewhere else or mention it in some other way. But to put a disclaimer atop the review a year after it was published and no one seemed to have any problem with it for all that time is outrageous. And I think is really caving into the notion that, I guess what's going on here is there's a certain wokeness in the air. And the feeling was that what Dennis Harvey wrote was very, you know, sexist and unwoke and therefore had to be addressed, you know, in the moment. But if you read the review, that's not what he wrote. You know?
Well, here's what Harvey said. I'm quoting from the LA Times. "I did not say or even mean to imply Mulligan is not hot enough for the role. I'm a 60-year-old gay man. I don't actually go around dwelling on the comparative hotnesses of young actresses, let alone writing about that." He went on to defend his characterization of the casting of Carey Mulligan. Lael, what do you think of you know, both sides of this issue?
I think it's, to use a tired analogy, I think it's kind of a Rashomon situation, actually. I think Carey Mulligan read into Dennis Harvey's review a comparison to Margot Robbie, who was a producer on the film. And he did at one point say, you could imagine someone like Margot Robbie in this part. She might not have relied as much on artifice as someone like Carey Mulligan does. And Mulligan took that to mean I'm not hot enough to play this role. And for a film that's particularly about the ways in which women have been objectified by men and women's response to that, it seemed a particularly out of touch and out of tune comment for Harvey to make. But it's more complicated than that. I don't think that he was saying she wasn't hot enough. I think it was perhaps he could have chosen his comments differently. I think he was saying that actors bring their baggage to different roles, and the baggage that Carey Mulligan, as a largely period actress, brings to this was something that was distracting from it. But it had been edited. Peter DeBruges edited it. And he, you know, the responsibility kind of lays with him to go over what Dennis Harvey wrote and to tweak that. You know, it's, I don't think that they should have issued an apology disclaimer a year after. I think that is kind of weird. And to be honest, Variety is an industry publication. It's a trade. I worked for Variety for a long time, and there is industry influence, and that always ends up playing into sometimes even reviews getting pulled for various reasons. So that's just a fact with the industry publication.
Wade, you have a quick thought on this dispute between the National Society of Film Critics and Variety?
I agree completely with everything that has been previously said. I would add only this. Harvey didn't do anything untoward in his review. We've all written, the whole point of being a film critic is you have an opinion and you state it and you stick behind it. And your editor is the person who is supposed to be the filter that makes sure that it is justified and it is shaped. And once that's done, it's done, and the publication should stand behind you. That's the whole point of criticism. At the same time, Carey Mulligan is perfectly entitled to be sensitive to what is said in reviews about her work. Everyone who is reviewed is entitled to that, and to say what she says. And she and Harvey should have done battle in the public square without Variety picking sides or apologizing. I do think, you know, Carey Mulligan misread the review, but I understand why, because British actresses have for a very long time been subjected to a double standard where being British is tantamount to not being very sexy, and you have to sort of be very upper stiff upper lip and play Downton Abbey parts. And when you get old, you're Maggie Smith. And I think British actresses are rightfully sensitive about that characterization and should fight to get out from under it if they feel that they're being pressured to adhere to it. I think that perhaps plays a part in Carey Mulligan's justifiable sensitivity. And again, she's entitled to that. Okay. Harvey's entitled to his review. Variety was not entitled to take sides.
All right. Thanks so much to our Film Week critics this week, Peter Rayner, Lael Lowenstein, and Wade Major. Coming up, Viggo Mortensen is going to be talking about his latest film in which he stars and also which he directed. And we remind you that our next Film Week event is a virtual one. Our screening series goes online Thursday, February 25th, 6:30 p.m. We talk The Incredibles with the film's director and composer. It's Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Just a reminder, you can get it every week wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Coming up now, we have a conversation with actor Viggo Mortensen, who makes his directorial debut with the new film Falling. Follows a tumultuous father-son relationship. Mortensen drew inspiration from his own life. He not only starred in the film and directed it, he wrote the screenplay and composed the score. Our John Horn talked with Viggo Mortensen at last year's Sundance Film Festival.
Viggo, I read that you started thinking about this story after the death of your mom. And this is clearly a story about a father. There's certainly a mother figure in it as well. But I'm curious how the thoughts that you had following your mother's funeral started to shape the story that you wanted to tell.
Well, I was on a plane flying overnight flight. And and since we'd just been to the funeral, my brothers and I and other people in the family, and had talked about my mother a lot, obviously, and had made, you know, a slideshow for the after sort of meal and all that. You know, all those images and things that she said that others remembered that maybe you didn't or were fresh in my mind, I wanted to write down some of the things that I'd remembered that I hadn't thought of in a long time. And so I was doing that in a notebook, and then I looked at them on the plane. I couldn't sleep because I was just thinking about that. And it seemed like you could cobble these together in a way. It could be a story, a short story. And so I started writing it, but it quickly became something else, another family. It wasn't really my mom. And since I was writing about my mom, then I started writing about my dad. And yes, it's true, although, I mean, and it's, you know, it's fiction. Only my brothers would recognize certain turns of phrase here and there, a couple of moments. It's more the dynamic between the characters rather than what they are on screen and where they live. But the dynamic between the man and the woman, who are parents, you know, it's there. But it's true that it's the father is the central figure, the character Lance plays, Willis. But to me, the conscience of the story, in a sense, you know, sort of the point around which everything revolves is Gwen, is the mother. Even though she's not in the movie throughout, she's there constantly. You see her. What they fight about is prompted by that, really.
When you were writing these notes and then thinking that it might be a movie and then writing a screenplay, what is the evolution to, I might want to direct this, I might want to star in it? Do they all happen simultaneously, or is there a progression of changes?
I got home and a couple days went by, and I went back and looked at this story that I ended up writing on the plane, thinking it's probably not that good. It's like those things you write in the middle of the night. You wake up and you write something down, or you write something on a plane and you're sort of sleepy, but you just write it anyway. And you think that's probably great, and you read it the next day. It's like, it's not very original, actually. I read it and I thought it was quite good. I liked the structure, which I basically respected in the screenplay eventually. But I thought I can visualize it, and so I think it could be a movie story. So I tried to write it as a script, and that came out very quickly. It was a couple of weeks, as opposed to other scripts I've written, which are months and months. And I always thought that I would direct it, but I didn't think I would be in it, because I thought that would be a little too much to take on. It just was, you know, it's a business. So in order to get some financing, I had to say I would do it. I would play that part. Being face to face, I could see if it was working or feel, you know, it's different than looking at it on a monitor, for which we didn't have a lot of time. We had a very short shoot. I didn't really look at the monitor very much. I remember when I first started, that's what directors did. They were there watching. They weren't looking at a screen because there weren't screens. I mean, when I started, it was the first sort of black and white little monitors, and they were kind of crappy, and then it evolved into what we have now. And now, there's a lot of directors that don't even look at the actors, really. But I like to be right in there watching, and you can't get closer than sitting face to face.
So much of your character, John, is holding everything inside. He is not going to rise. He's not going to take the bait, because I guess he feels, what, it won't matter?
No, it's because, like, what if you notice, the first time, when he finally says that in the kitchen, he says, I promised myself, and he says, and I'm speaking slowly because it's trying to stay calm. Because the idea, hopefully it comes across, is that inside, I'm not calm at all. But it's, I promised myself I was not going to rise to the bait and get into another big blowout. In other words, for decades, I have been... obviously, when I say another big blowout, I'm not going to get into it. For decades, what I've learned is any time I get into a fight with him, I lose. In other words, if I discuss things with him on his terms, yelling and screaming and insulting, he either walks out of the house, hangs up the phone, or says the most horrible thing possible, and I walk out of the room or something, and that it just falls apart. Or on a previous visits, one can imagine, and this is part of the way I like to tell this movie and the kind of movies I like, where not everything's spelled out. It's not like I say, remember last time, and then you left after the second day, you were supposed to say 2 weeks. No, you don't have to say that. You can assume that previously things like that have happened. It's like, take me to the airport. I'm like, okay. So it's years of experience of deciding, okay, that doesn't do any good, and he is having the onset of dementia. So since he's suffering from that, I have to be even more patient. And in order to achieve what I want, which is for him to move into a safe place where we can keep an eye on him and help him, I have to swallow a lot more crap. That's all that is, really. It's not because I'm like a... Because some people misunderstand. They go, well, what is he, like a saint? And then this other guy's an asshole? It's like, no, it's not like that. They both have their flaws, but the younger man is trying to help the other one, his father, whom he loves in spite of everything that's said, but the only way to help him is to take a lot of crap. Otherwise, you're not going to get it done.
When you think about how other directors have influenced your way of seeing movies and making movies, how do you separate all of those influences from what you want to do? How much are they coloring the way that you're approaching filmmaking? And at what point is your own style, as opposed to a composite of what you've learn from other directors you've worked with?
I just assumed in directing that it would be like acting, in the sense that as an actor, I always prepare as thoroughly as I can. I read far and wide, sometimes research in areas that are just only barely connected to the screenplay. And then I put it aside, and then we start shooting. And I just assume that's all in there. And that's going to come to my aid almost subconsciously. I've done the work. Now let's play. And I give all my attention to the other actor and to the director. As a director, I feel the same. I worked on it, worked on it. We worked, Lance and I. I worked with the other actors. I thought about the shots I wanted to do. I talked to the cinematographer about it well before. We scouted half a year before. We shot all that footage that you see that summer and autumn well before. So then you just start and you assume it's all there. And in terms of the movies I've seen, the directors I respect, I rewatch certain movies, thought about it. But even though there's a lot of shots that I admire that work in certain movies in terms of, you know, things that we are going to try to do in our movie, which is to evoke memory or how subjective memory is about the same person or the same moment from two points of view. And there are directors who have done that in certain ways that I admire, but I would never copy it. I just take that all in. It's in here, and we're going to do things as it feels right on the day. That's what I did.
That's KPCC's John Horn talking with Viggo Mortensen, who wrote, directed, and starred in the new film Falling. You can see it on multiple video on demand platforms. Also want to let you know that our next Film Week screening event is going to be a virtual one Thursday, February 25th. All the details, kpcc.org/in-person. Have a great weekend.